dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of its battle spaces that often is neglected, I'm sorry to say, by too many of us in official Washington and elsewhere, is Latin America. That is the special beat, however, of our first guest. He is the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune, also the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets. He is, of course, Russ Dallin, a wonderful friend of this program. We're always delighted to have him with us, I believe, for the first time this year. Russ, Happy New Year to you. Welcome back. We have a man on the move at the moment. His name is Juan Guaido. He is the, well, substantially internationally recognized leader of the nation of Venezuela, though the man who continues to run the place into the ground, Nicolas Maduro, hasn't gotten along with the program. Where is Juan Guaido at the moment, Russ, and what is he up to?
It's almost like a Where's Waldo thing. Well, first of all, let me tell you, he's in London at the moment. He's meeting with Boris Johnson today, as well as Venezuelan expatriates in London. But he was banned from leaving the country. So he snuck out of the country to meet with Secretary of State Pompeo, as well as the president of Colombia, President Duque, yesterday in Bogota for meeting on terrorism, appropriately, given Colombia's neighbor and Venezuela's long-standing support of everyone from the FARC to the ELN to Cuba and vice versa. So he snuck out and met with Secretary of State Pompeo and Duque, and they all gave him support. He flew to London. He's meeting with Boris Johnson there today in a show of support from the UK. He's also meeting with Dominic Raab, who's the UK Foreign Secretary. And he's on his way after that to Davos, where so many of our intellectual and economic and political leaders get together for a powwow in the mountains, where Mr. Trump, President Trump, will be also attending this year. And suppose it is believed that there will be a meeting between Juan Guaido and President Trump, who actually this morning was talking about the shows of support.
So where does it stand at the moment with respect to the support? Is all well and good, but is there any evidence on the ground that things are moving in the direction of a post-Maduro, post-Chavez Venezuela? Or is it pretty much steady state with the people of Venezuela suffering terribly, but no end in sight?
It's a little bit of both. At the end of last year, in December, there was a lot of stock taking about what has been accomplished and what has not been accomplished. The sanctions, the oil sanctions put on almost a year ago on January 28th of 2019, had a tremendous impact on Venezuela, halving its production, which was already far below what they had in the 20 years ago before communism came to the country and devastated everything like a horde of locusts, but basically cut production so that last month, according to OPEC, Venezuela produced only 714,000 barrels a day. That is down from 1998 when Chavez came to power and the communists came to power, and production was then 3.5 million barrels a day. So we're talking 20% of what production was 22 years ago. So if you need an example of how well communism works to destroy the major, industry and one of the most important raw materials in the world, Venezuela is your example.
You've mentioned some of the privations that have been taking place there. Gas shortages in a nation awash with oil is ironic and apparently having a very, very devastating effect on what's left of the economy and the people. Is it correct, Russ Dallin, that the average wage in Venezuela is $2 per month? How do people survive under these circumstances?
They don't. Well, they survive on hope. They survive barely, not even enough to feed on some government handouts. The government creates loyalty by having you dependent on them, as dictatorships and communist dictatorships so often do. But most of the people don't and leave the country, or they get remittances from the United States or from their relatives who have gone elsewhere to work. I have two employees that have worked for me since 1998 and 2000. Both have had European passports all of this time. One just left to live in Madrid because he couldn't stand it anymore in Venezuela. And another one leaves next month to live in Germany, who's had a German European passport for the last couple of decades. And they have just thrown in the towel finally on that country. So we've already seen 5 million people leave this country. That's, you know, almost 20% of the population leaving. And we continue to see that, because you hit the nail on the head, you cannot live on $3. You can hope that things are going to get better, but the problem is that hope is not a strategy and does not work in a situation run by people who refuse to believe in the laws of economics that make all of our normal economies work, and the rule of law as well.
Rustellan, quickly, the way this has been perpetrated, as best I can tell, we've talked about this a lot last year, and I assume it's ongoing, is foreign governments are propping up this regime. It's making it possible for it to hang on. If you had a word of advice for President Trump at this moment, perhaps Juan Guaido is going to pass this along if he has a chance, but what would it be? What more can we do at this moment to affect that, you know, sort of life support for this regime, which seems to be the last pillar of its tenure on power?
Well, we've gone back to the 1980s in terms of foreign policy, and that Russia is the main bugbear in our era supporting Venezuela, and Russia's not doing it for free, and they're not doing it just to annoy us, although that's a side benefit. They're making money, and they have loaned Venezuela the Rosneft, the Russian oil company, has loaned Venezuela $6.5 billion and have made them pay them less than $300 million on that. In the meantime, they've mortgaged Citgo to 49% of Citgo to Rosneft. And of course, Russia itself is also involved because they've been selling them arms, and over $3 billion are owed just for the Sukhoi jet fighters and helicopters and anti-US, or the anti-aircraft, anti-missile systems that Mr. Putin also sold to his colony, which is essentially what Venezuela has come. They learned from the 1980s, the Russians have learned, they're not going to just support a Cuba just for the hell of supporting them. They are bleeding Venezuela dry and making money from it.
We definitely need to add this to the list of things that need to be punished in Russia. Thank you so much, Rustellan, for the important work that you do at the Latin American Herald Tribune, keeping an eye on all of this and letting the rest of us know about it. I hope you'll be a frequent visitor with us in 2020. We're always glad to have you with us. God bless you, my friend. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about the Phase 1 deal, Taiwan, and more with one of our country's great experts on Asia right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of our country's tremendous resources when it comes to matters involving Asia, most especially communist China. But Gordon is a big picture guy who has written extensively on these issues, including in The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea, his three wonderful books. You can follow him at the Daily Beast or at Twitter. His handle is Gordon G. Chang. He is also published at the National Interest and National Review and Fox News and elsewhere, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Gordon. Thank you for joining us. Gordon, I wanted to follow up on the conversation we had last week about the stunning results of the election in Taiwan by noting a remarkable statement by the woman who won those elections, Tsai Ing-wen. Her comment to the Chinese, who have been rather unhappy, shall we say, with the outcome of the election was, well, basically, get over it. She said, quote, "Taiwan is an independent country already," unquote. Did that surprise you? And where do you think that leaves things?
In one sense, it did surprise me, Frank, largely because it is an assertive comment. And she has generally not been an assertive president. She has tried, and to her credit, she has tried to manage the relationship with Beijing so as to preserve Taiwan's independence. Because every day that Taiwan survives is a victory. So for her to say that after the election, I thought was really quite interesting. And I'm glad she did, because she's telling the truth. Taiwan, as a practical matter, is an independent country. There are other countries that recognize it, and it's important for the free world, including the United States. So I'm glad she said it, and I'm glad that U.S. officials are now paying more attention to her and paying more respect to Taiwan. And one of the other things that she said, Frank, was that basically Beijing has to respect the people of Taiwan. That's also an important comment.
Gordon, how has China responded to that statement?
Well, China has responded with its typical just arrogance and complete ununderstanding of what's going on in Taiwan. Xi Jinping has again said there has to be a time limit. This can't go on forever, he says, referring to Taiwan being independent, because Beijing takes the position that Taiwan is its 34th province. So there are threatening words. There was a supposed leak of a picture of the PLA, People's Liberation Army of China, planning an invasion of Taiwan. More psychological warfare, of course. I'm actually quite concerned because there has been a drumbeat of propaganda releases. And whether the Chinese are serious or not, the U.S. needs to come out with a clear declaration saying we are defending Taiwan, so Beijing won't even try something.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that there is a heightened pucker factor, shall we say, at the moment, and all the more reason why we need to be standing firmly with Taiwan and helping deter the Chinese. Gordon, at the same time, we have had the president signing off on this new phase one big, beautiful monster of a trade deal with China, as he put it. You've had a chance now to study its actual contents and to make some preliminary assessments, at least, as to what is likely to come of it. Give us your thoughts.
The most important aspect of this agreement is China's commitment to buy $200 billion more of U.S. goods and services over the 2017 baseline. And this is important because we're moving away from free trade with China to managed trade. And I think other countries are going to do the same, because you just can't have free trade with a semi-command economy. So this is an important change. We're now dealing with China the way it actually is. It's unfortunate in a sense, but if you're going to have any commerce with China, this is the way to do it. Now, I would, of course, as we've talked about before, prefer not to have any agreement with Beijing for a number of reasons. But if you're going to have an agreement with China, this is the way that we've got to go. And I think this is the way the world's got to go as well. And we're going to see more and more countries demand firm commitments from China about the imports of goods and services.
And that's what you mean by managed trade. There have to be specific obligations and they have to be enforced, right?
Right. And as a matter of fact, if there's going to be the phase two of the trade agreement, as everyone's been talking about, then I think there should really just be one provision, and that is that China cannot sell more to the United States than we sell to China. We should stop trying to reform China. It doesn't work. We've got decades of experience in that regard. So instead of saying to the Chinese, oh, you got to open up your market or whatever, just say to them, look, you know, if you sell us $100 billion, we're going to sell you $100 billion. And if you don't buy more than $100 billion from us, you're not selling more than $100 billion to the United States. Again, this is not the best way to conduct trade, but it is the only way to conduct trade with a China that does not believe in comparative advantage, the notion that underlines international commerce.
And reciprocity and all that. Gordon, there was one thing that jumped out at me in the analysis that you did at the Daily Beast. And that was that I think you said, quote, there are mechanisms in the phase one deal by which the U.S. can reimpose tariffs for noncompliance. And Beijing is not permitted to retaliate for any proportional American snapbacks of tariffs made in good faith, unquote. That sounds unlikely to be followed. Am I missing something?
You're not missing anything, Frank. The provisions in the enforcement agreement are much better than the provisions in any other enforcement provision that we've seen with China. But, you know, you can't actually have something which is enforceable, which says they won't retaliate, because there's so many ways for Beijing to retaliate. And they can do so outside of the trade agreement. They can do so outside of the whole area of trade. They will retaliate. Now, the important thing here is that the way the United States deals with China is it just imposes more Section 301 tariffs on the Chinese. So there's a lot of things that can be done to clobber the Chinese into compliance. But, you know, this is an advance, as I said, but it's not enough of an advance. You can't deal with a regime like China, unfortunately, in good faith. You can have a good faith agreement with Canada and Mexico, as we have with the USMCA. You can even have a good faith agreement with the European Union, although that's getting increasingly difficult. But the point is, it is just not possible to have the Chinese comply with an agreement that they've made with us in good faith on trade or anything else.
Well, we will be following how they perform, and I very strongly support what you've said, Gordon, in terms of managing the trade going forward. Let me turn to another, and I think, honestly, of your many insights, Gordon, this is one of the most important, it seems to me. What the Chinese have been up to, essentially in terms of taking down the multilateral institutions that the United States had a very important role in building in the post-World War II era. It's a piece you published on the 14th of January at Gatestone Institute, an absolutely terrific organization, entitled, quote, China is destroying multilateralism. Trump is creating a new order, end quote. Tell us a little bit about what China is doing inside of these various multilateral organizations that's having the effect of hollowing them out and in some cases actually, you know, negating them altogether.
Yeah, the important thing here is that China's been subverting multilateral institutions, and it has been, in many ways, opening them up to penetration by China. So, for instance, there is a Chinese national, Huang Lu, who is the Secretary General of the Montreal-based International Civil Aviation Organization. And what she did was she helped cover up a Chinese cyber attack on the ICAO. It was considered to be the most serious in that institution's history. Another Chinese national was directly involved in making sure that there was no effective response, and Fang Lu protected that individual. So really what we're having is, you know, in a very direct way, a subversion of these institutions. And this is going to get even more serious because China has nominated one of their officials to head the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a agency of the UN. The election is this March, and I just hope that Wang Binyang does not get elected. I don't think that will happen, but nonetheless, this whole notion that China would head the WIPO is just beyond belief.
It really is. I mean, this is a country, of course, that is, as you've pointed out on this program, among other places, Gordon, engaged in, what is it, $500 billion worth of intellectual property theft per annum against just this country, let alone others. It's unbelievable that they would put somebody in charge of a multilateral organization with the responsibility for overseeing good conduct in this space.
Yeah, it's just horrible, you know, and we have seen what the effect is. You know, just today, for instance, you know, we learned that a Chinese national, Meng Hongwei, was sentenced to 13 and a half years in prison in China for corruption. he was, until he was disappeared, the head of Interpol. You know, you just go through this. That was just today's news. But you just go through this institution after institution where we've tried to bring the Chinese in to integrate Beijing into the international system. What has happened is that China has delegitimized this whole idea of multilateralism by subverting these multilateral institutions. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Trump's attacking multilateralism. No, he's actually defending it. And that's an important point that we should look going forward, that Trump has actually done a lot of good things to defend good order in the world.
You know, two other organizations come to mind, and we have to leave it at this, Gordon, the World Bank, and they've been getting funding from it, even though they are long since ceased, it seems to me, to be a developing country, and the World Trade Organization, which they've essentially hollowed out from within. And at the same time, they're also building their own multilateral institutions in a number of respects so that they can even more, you know, fully control what's being done on that stage. Gordon, such an important piece at the Gatestone Institute, as is all of your writing. It's really appreciated that you come visit with us each week to talk about it. Thank you for doing so. We'll look forward to catching up with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman about economic warfare in other respects right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and a host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman on Blaze TV. He is the author of Game Plan and Secret Weapon. He blogs at globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is our duty expert on economic warfare and so much more. Of course, he is the great Kevin Freeman. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Welcome. The president is in Davos today. He spoke earlier in the day. And one of the things that seems to be very much on people's minds in the finance community is the importance of subordinating profit to certain moral imperatives as they see them. And I'm sort of struck that something called ESG, by which I gather they mean environment, social, and governance as investment priorities, is trumping the pursuit of profits and apparently return on investment and so on. Kevin, what are we to make of this phenomenon, and what other priorities might be given prominence if you're going to say it's not just about the money? We're going to advance, well, for example, national security interests of the United States.
Well, first off, it shouldn't always be only about the money. That's very short-sighted, because monetary considerations are often very short-term relative to long-term good of society. So I understand when people like Larry Fink, who's the investment manager overseeing $6 trillion at BlackRock, begins a conversation that it shouldn't always be exclusively about the return on investment. But I'm very concerned, because I understand Larry Fink oversees $6 trillion. Number one, it's not his money. And number two, I don't know what his priorities are. I'm comfortable when he's saying, I'm managing your money to get you the greatest possible return. But when he says, I'm going to lower that on the priority list and I'm going to start looking for alternatives, I worry that his view of the world and mine may be different, and me giving him money to invest may mean that he's using my money against my values, and that's very concerning.
It is, and that's especially true when the agenda of this ESG crowd seems so very political in character. Could you talk a little bit about what the agenda is on that front?
Yeah, well, the vast majority of ESG investing, which is environmental, social, and governance, as you mentioned, the vast majority of some $30 trillion worldwide is allocated to fighting climate change, which is, you know, sounds like a lofty and wonderful goal. But my question is, is fighting that meaning we're going to reduce the GDP of countries worldwide because they're outputting too much? Does that mean that we're going to favor one nation over another, and so that we will hold the United States to very strict climate standards, but will allow China and India to skirt the rules? You know, what is this, a wealth transfer? Is this actually investing in things that are going to make us more successful? Nobody really knows what that is. It's very sloshy and soft. And the fear that I have is that this has just become a marketing fad, and it's handing money to people who have values very different from mine. And it's potentially a bubble in the making in the investment world.
It's also obviously going to deprive financing to companies that are deemed to be at odds with that climate change agenda, notably those in the fossil fuel sector. Does that trouble you as well, Kevin, as a guy who is very focused on energy security of the United States?
Well, let's step back just for a second. And we saw the Iranians shoot missiles at and destroy a portion of the Saudi oil fields. And that happened just last year. Had that happened in a different geopolitical oil environment, had it happened when we didn't have hydraulic fracking and the Texas miracle and, you know, the fact that the United States has become virtually energy independent, it would have ruined the economy. It would have skyrocketed oil prices. It would have been devastating. But the reality of it is that we produce enough energy here that we can withstand those kind of geopolitical shocks without causing it to spiral down. Net result, gasoline prices did not go to $6, $8 a gallon. Had we been in a restrict fossil fuels environment in the United States mode, we might have seen that hit on our economy, and it could have been the beginning of something really terrible that in the long run would probably be worse for the environment, not better.
And worse for our economy, too, needless to say, and our energy security posture. Kevin Freeman, let me ask you about a sort of related subject, China. China, I think, is afoul of the environment. It is afoul of social values. It is afoul of good governance with respect to the way it conducts business. And yet, it doesn't seem as though Larry Fink or people like him who have this ESG focus to their investing strategies have any trouble at all investing in Chinese communist companies and enterprises tied to the Chinese Communist Party. Am I missing something here?
No, you're making a great point, Frank. Absolutely correct. Everybody gives China a pass. Why? Because China actually lobbies, funds, and pushes for them to be ignored. I have a friend who lived in China for a number of years, and he recently passed away. And the net cause of it was air pollution, tremendous, horrible air pollution that he dealt with day in and day out. And it ended in his very young death in his 50s. It's tragic. They are not caring for the environment. They are getting a pass in so many places, and we're not considering when we invest in China, we just look at the profit opportunity. I mean, this is the irony of this. The claim that we have to invest in China because that's where the profits are comes out of the same side or out of the same mouth that will say out of the other side, oh, but we can't make profit our primary motivation. And you made the point earlier. We ought to make our nation's benefit, our national security, preserving the American way of life. We ought to make that a priority in our investing as well. And I think that's what the American people would like to see. And that's why we started the National Security Investment Consultant Institute.
Tell us a little bit about that, Kevin, because I think this is such an incredibly important initiative.
Well, you know, as you have the people on Wall Street creating ESG to their benefit, what we've created is a training program to train financial advisors so that people can say, I want my stockbroker, my financial planner, my insurance agent, my CPA, I want them aware of how my money is being invested. And I want them to help me invest it so that I benefit America and I preserve our freedoms for future generations. That the people that actually own the money will want their money invested to match their values rather than sending it off to Wall Street and having the Wall Street people decide. So it doesn't mean you have to leave your relationship with Merrill Lynch. You just should want your Merrill Lynch broker aware of the national security implications of your investments. And so they get trained. We've been doing the training. We've done it at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. We've done it at Hillsdale College. We're talking with Liberty University about doing it there via their online. We train advisors. Then they work with clients to make sure that their investments match their values going forward, particularly in the area of national security.
And how can you, if you are an investor, Kevin Freeman, make sure that your advisor, your financial manager, is trained to understand how to invest your money in a manner that is compatible with and supportive of our national security and well-being?
Well, the first thing you should do is go to nsic.org, nsic.org, and register there. We are revamping our program so that we can broaden it. We ran two pilot programs, like I mentioned, Oklahoma and in Hillsdale College in Washington. We're going to roll it out this year in a big way, but we would love to have your name and your financial advisor's name so that we can contact them and let them know when the program is fully available. This is my way of helping to keep America on the right path and helping people to have their investment dollars match their values.
It couldn't be more important, obviously, but we're finding in connection with the work of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, to which you have made a major contribution over the past 9 months, Kevin Freeman, this business of not only making sure our money's being used to advance our national security and not used by our adversaries to undermine it is truly a no-brainer. And I salute you for this National Security Investment Consultant Institute initiative and look forward to learning much more about it as you progress with hopefully Liberty University. Let me ask you quickly, Kevin, you spoke to me recently about a term that another friend and colleague, Steve Young, has introduced me to as well. I'd like you just to quickly give us a flavor of what you mean by moral capitalism.
Right. Well, the problem that capitalism is the best system of all systems in that it creates the greatest amount of wealth. The problems are twofold with it. Number one is there's a tendency to create wealth at the expense of the public good, which would be immoral. And so we need to have moral capitalism. And the second aspect is there's a tendency of wealth concentration. So we need democratic capitalism. The people that get in power and have the money, they tend to create and write the rules so that they're the only ones that can make the money. And so when you have moral democratic capitalism, it's available to all and it's acting with a moral aspect, which Adam Smith, who is known as the founder of capitalism, wrote the book The Wealth of Nations, was a moral philosopher. He also wrote the book The Theory of Moral Sentiments. So that's what we need. That's the most successful system, is to have moral democratic capitalism.
We will be talking much more about this in the days ahead. I have the feeling that ESG, as you've described it, and the bubble that it may be developing is an example of, well, if not immoral capitalism, certainly non-moral and democratic capitalism at work, and we need to call them on it. Kevin Freeman, thank you so much for joining us today for the great work you do at Economic War Room at The Blaze TV. Find out how you can subscribe at economicwarroom.com. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. We'll speak with one of my personal heroes in the wars on behalf of persecuted Christians, Nina Shea of the Hudson Institute, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I feel honored to say that we have in-house one of my personal heroes. Her name is Nina Shea. She is these days the director of the Center for Religious Freedom and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. For many years, she served with great distinction as a commissioner on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. She is the author of numerous books and countless periodical essays and the like. The most recent of her books, I believe, is persecuted the global assault on Christians. Nina, it is so much appreciated that you're with us, and as is your work. It is especially so against the backdrop of something that we heard last week from a group that we both work with, Open Doors USA, who do these annual World Watch reports on the plight of Christians around the world. And their current estimate is that there are now 260 million Christians who are being heavily persecuted. That's a subset of an even larger and staggering number. Thank you for the work that you do on their behalf, and thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Frank, for having me and for shining attention, as always, on this issue over many years yourself. So it's very important. Open Doors is tracking this, and it's apparent that it's getting worse. We had been focused like a laser on the Middle East for many years because of ISIS. Now it's traveled to Africa, and Christians up and down the continents are being slaughtered for their faith. And I just got the traumatic news this morning that a man that I had written about, a pastor, a Protestant pastor, who's head of the Christians African Nigeria Association in a northern state of Adamawa in Nigeria, was beheaded yesterday. I had written about him about a week ago in the National Catholic Register. He had been taken hostage, and Boko Haram had, this is the terror group that's affiliated with ISIS. It's formally affiliated, sworn fealty to ISIS, released a film a couple weeks ago saying that they had him as a hostage. And he was saying that he would do God's will, that he would accept his fate. And yesterday, his fate was that they beheaded him because he is a Christian. And this has been going on. And every week, every day, there's more news along this line. Over Christmas, on Christmas, 10 or 11 Christians were beheaded by ISIS, the same group in Nigeria. I got their names, but I know virtually nothing about them. They were men dragged off a bus. They were probably asked to say the Shahada, that is the statement of faith of Islam. They refused. They were Christian, and they were beheaded on film, just like ISIS was doing in the Middle East. It's now doing in West Africa.
Nina, let me just ask you, because I think when people hear this kind of information, if they can process it at all, it is unbelievable that it's happening not only on this scale, but in our time, on, if you will, our watch. Tell us a little bit about why it's happening in Africa. As you say, you've written powerfully about this in the National Catholic Register a week or so ago, and under the heading, Africa's Young Christian Communities Are Now in Islamic Extremist Crosshairs. There seems to be a fair amount of denial going on, at least in official Washington and elsewhere, about the impetus behind this. You've mentioned Boko Haram, the Islamic State, and Fulani militants. Who are these people who are responsible for this kind of bloodletting and persecution?
Well, there are three major groups. One is Boko Haram, that itself is split into two, but there's no difference between them. And they both swore fealty to ISIS. ISIS accepted only one, but their attitude towards Christians, their behavior towards Christians is exactly the same, both groups. They're a vicious, violent Islamist fundamentalist group. They want to establish an Islamic state in Africa, not just Nigeria, but around. According to the Catholic Bishops Conference head, according to, you know, the local Christian leaders, that is their aim. And they already operate in an area that's completely Sharia controlled. So but that's not enough for them. They want to have this political power themselves.
and the resources and the territory that would come with driving the Christians out of the areas that they currently reside in. But we're being told, Nina, and you've heard this, I'm sure, as have I, that it's really just a conflict between herdsmen and farmers, as though this overlay of religiosity doesn't have anything to do with it. What are we to make of that and the government's response as a result?
Yeah, that explanation doesn't wash. It's completely wrong. This middle belt, what I just described about the ISIS group, is in northern Nigeria, northern belt, it's called. This is a massive area. Nigeria is the largest, most populous country in Africa, the largest economy. So it's not just, you know, it's not some backwater. I think it's 10% of all Catholic priests now are coming from Nigeria. The northern belt is this ISIS infiltrated and infested place. And then the middle belt is what you were talking about, these herdsmen versus sedentary farmers and nomadic herdsmen, the Fulani. There's a component within the Fulani that have been radicalized, and they're just as violent. And there's now, and they're murdering Christians. They have been murdering Christians. It's not about global warming. It's about taking Christians' land, driving them off the land, driving them into camps. And there is evidence now that they are actually training and sending apprentices, young men, to the Boko Haram area to learn the tactics and techniques and ideology. So they're intertwined. They're becoming intertwined.
So Nina, the challenge that we're facing here, it seems, in Nigeria and some of the surrounding nations, the Lake Chad region as it's known, is that we will see perhaps half that population of 200 million or more that are Christians driven from the land, driven perhaps even out of the country, or yes, as you say, wiped out, and creating a catastrophe for not just the immediate region, but for the continent as well, and perhaps far beyond, because there aren't any countries in Africa, I think, that are going to be able to absorb tens, if not 100 million people desperately in need of refuge and food and medicine and everything else. So this seems to me, and I've learned a lot from our mutual mentor, former Congressman Frank Wolf, about the importance of the United States helping to stave off this imminent catastrophe. What are your thoughts about that, and specifically his recommendation that we need a special envoy to try to sort of harness the U.S. government's policy apparatus and resources in a way that could make a difference on the ground there?
Yes, we need to have more intensive diplomacy that can understand what some of the problems are, troubleshoot some of them, put pressure on the local governments, the central government of Nigeria, for example, to better protect these people. These countries get U.S. aid, they get U.S. intelligence. They don't use it to protect these religions, these villagers in the outskirts. They use it to protect themselves. And the government of Burkina Faso as well. And that's another country, smaller country in West Africa. And the Fulani are coming across the border there. The Fulani are very large tribe. And like I said, that there's a portion of them that have been radicalized. They're using the same tactics, killing. A month or two ago, they went into a Protestant church and killed 14 people and the pastor. So during Sunday services. So this has been going on since the beginning of 2019. So it's brand new. They went through Mali, and wiped out an entire Christian village in Mali. No one even talks about that. So there is a conspiracy of silence, and there's a vacuum of knowledge about these places on the part of our government.
We are trying to fill it with Save the Persecuted Christians, and I know you are intensively, of course, at the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, which you direct so ably. Nina Shea, thank you for joining us from time to time with these updates. I hope we'll do a lot of it in 2020, because we need to contend with this scourge of anti-Christian persecution, and your leadership is indispensable to it. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.